trickle in here, so we'll get started. Lesson 57.
5 seconds. 5 seconds. Somebody's going to start. 5 seconds.
You know you're on video doing that now.
Sorry.
Oh, all right. For those of you that wonder, that was David Amaral. So we are going to get started. Lesson 57. The American Millenarian Movement, 1800 to 1860. Now, everything we've talked about so far has, regarding the American Millenarian Movement and dispensational resurgence and dispensational understanding of Pauline theology, has been all over across the Atlantic in England, in Great Britain, and so forth. So what I want to do, start doing today, is transitioning now to what's going on in the United States and how these ideas come across and begin to impact the believers here in the United States. Before we do that, though, I did want to just quickly say, I did get some encouraging news this week. I got an email from Brother Jordan, and he's asked me in April to come to the pastor's conference and teach two lessons on the history of dispensationalism at the pastor's conference. So I am going to go do that. Now the big challenge is figuring out of 57 hours worth of stuff what I'm going to talk about in two. So anyway, it's encouragement to me to know that, you know, that that this is going to be shared with a wider audience than, and it's having an impact beyond just what we're doing here in this class. So, Lesson 57, the American Millenarian Movement, 1800 to 1860. Yeah?
He said two lessons. Did he say how long they had to be?
No, he didn't say how long they had to be. So, I'm assuming he wants about an hour time frame, but, you know, we'll do the best we can. All right, so, as I just said at the beginning, we're going to focus now on what's going on in the United States. We've talked about Edward Irving. We've talked about the historic premillennialists, the Killists, the traditional guys that were over there in England. We talked about how Darby and the Brethren sort of branch off and emerge from all that stuff going on over there. We studied in detail the issue of the rapture, the attacks on Darby's teaching on the pre-tribulation rapture. I outlined for you an overview of Darby's dispensational scheme. Then we spent 2 weeks looking specifically at what he has to say about the current dispensation that we're living in now. So this morning, the American Millenarian Movement, I want to switch gears and head or come back to the United States for a while and look at some things that are going on while all that's going on in England. While Edward Irving, while you have Darby getting started over there, the Brethren are arguing, splitting, dividing, and all sorts of things are going on. The truth is being recovered and taught in various places to varying degrees. The Brethren are sending out missionaries and so on through continental Europe. In the United States, things were happening as well that are going to have an impact on the greater story. Now I hope that we haven't been so far away from it for so long that you've lost sight of the fact that the overarching theme that we're following through here is the Millenarian Movement and how dispensational Bible study emerged within that movement and how it affected that movement, and now we want to look at it in the United States. So, postmillennialism, American-made millenarianism. America in the early 19th century was drunk on the millennium. Whether in the support of optimism or pessimism, radicalism or conservatism, Americans seem unable to avoid, seem bound to utilize the vocabulary of Christian eschatology. In the United States, Protestants, reflecting their brimming optimism and hope, was expressed most frequently as a blending of millenarianism and American nationalism. Stemming from the Puritan conviction that the colonists were a chosen people and their commonwealth a city set upon a hill, reinforced by the War of Independence and the potentialities of the West, Americans vied with each other in producing greater and more glorious prospects for the United States. You have to understand that embedded within the culture of the United States at its founding was a real mentality that We are going to create the sort of idyllic society based on the Bible in the United States. The Puritans definitely thought that. They definitely sought to establish that. They thought that the War of Independence and their victory proved that. And so there was very much a strong post-millennial bent during the first 100 years of the founding of the United States, where the country was viewed as sort of the great, you know, religious experiment, and that they were going to bring in the kingdom, and there was a very much a post-millennialist sort of view. The dominance of post-millennialism came as a surprise. Most of the Protestants and Catholics who settled colonial America were overwhelmingly and officially amillennialists. However, most Puritans who settled New England held historicist premillennial views that had grown popular in England in the early to mid-17th century. Then the unexpected happened. The first Great Awakening of the 1740s generated thousands of conversions and hundreds of new churches. Jonathan Edwards, borrowing heavily from the prophetic writings of Daniel Whitby, concluded that God was using such ordinary means of grace to Christianize the world and bring in a golden millennial age before Christ's return. So all these things that are happening are being viewed as sort of the beginning of the golden idyllic age of the church, and that God was going to use America to Christianize the world and you know, bring in this if you will, a utopic age before the return of Christ. So there's definitely post-millennialism flying through the country during this time. Although the results of the First Great Awakening faded fast, the post-millennial expectations were revived and validated by the even more impressive second Great Awakening in the early 19th century. Popular commentaries throughout these periods by Matthew Henry, Thomas Scott, and Adam Clark articulated a post-millennial understanding of the Bible that became deeply rooted in the evangelical churches. Look, if you go to a store like Family Christian Stores, by the way, that's a weak store if you want to buy serious Bible study books, okay? Don't even bother going there. But if you do, and you go to the commentary section, every one of them has Matthew Henry, probably Adam Clark, and maybe Thomas Scott. Because they're like, at any Bible software program that you buy, always has Matthew Henry, Adam Scott. These are sort of the canned commentary sets that everybody sells and that everybody sort of looks to, at least those who, you know, really don't want to, you know, study the Bible from a dispensational point of view. So these men write these commentaries. They become sort of standardized in the American evangelical churches, and all of them are post-millennial in their approach and their understanding to the Scripture. So this emerging idea of what it means to be American is really driving a post-millennial resurgence in the United States, and it's becoming an identity for a lot of Americans during this time period. According to Bluebird and Chung, historians have called antebellum America an evangelical empire characterized by optimism, growth, and democratic ideals. Religious and political leaders alike viewed the new nation in millennial terms as a city upon a hill with a special role to play in the world. So this was the way that people viewed the country back then. And so it dovetailed into a strong post-millennial understanding of the Bible, especially during the years we're looking at here between 1800 and the year 1680. Postmillennialism joined forces with the surge of democratic ideals to make American Protestants boldly evangelical and activist. Operating with the certainty of prophetic promises, evangelicals built schools, churches, publishing houses, and missionary agencies in order to carry out God's plan to Christianize America and the world. Their strategy included both religion and politics. Evangelists such as Charles Finney told their converts to apply Christian principles to social and political causes and predicted that if they did so, the millennium was just around the corner. So, But major commentators of the day, the major popular evangelists of the day, are all working to promote this sort of post-millennial view, and also along with that, the role of America in establishing this Christian era. And so the people bought into this, the evangelical Christians of the era definitely buy into this, and so there is a strong post-millennial bent in American churches as a result of all of this. Samuel H. Cox summarized the post-millennialism of Americans in a speech made before the first meeting of the Evangelical Alliance in 1846. Allow me to say that in America, the state of society is without parallel in universal history. With all our mixtures, there is a leaven of heaven. There is a goodness there. There is an excellent principle there. I really believe that God has got America within anchorage, and upon that arena, He intends to display His prodigies. Is that right? Yeah, prodigies for the millennium. So what's this guy saying about the United States? That a special nation, that God is, you know, blessing the country and using it as a sort of a standard bearer or a example of what He's trying to do, what He wants to do, and what He wants to accomplish. Now, just as an aside, I read that stuff and I think, boy, oh boy, where are we at now? Okay, it's amazing to think that the country could have, even though in my opinion they were admittedly wrong with their post-millennial understanding of Scripture, there was at least a reverence for the Bible and a sense that God, you know, that God was trying to accomplish something and that He was going to use Christians and the gospel to do it. Well, I don't agree with obviously everything they say about it or how it was going to happen, but to go from that being a central tenet and view of what the country was to where we are now is just astounding to me. So by the middle of the 19th century, British millenarian theology had been imported into the United States and had become the most popular form of American millenarianism. But this triumph occurred only after the luxuriant flourishing of a native millenarian species that imposed special conditions and traditions upon every other American adaptation. American millenarian owes most of this character to its British heritage. British millenarian teachings made no appreciable impact upon American churches until after 1845. Okay? So, before we move on to the next point, does anybody have any questions or comments about point number one this morning? Ronnie?
I did not understand that last section. There was already a millenary theology here in the U.S.
Yes. And the British version comes across, according to Sandine here, and begins to affect the way the Americans are interpreting things around 1845. So there's already a post-millennial bent before this happens. Now, it's a post-millennial bent. So this historicist pre-millennial bent that we've been looking at across the pond, as it were, in England, does not begin to make its way across and have an impact in America until around 1845. So, till about 1845, virtually most Americans, their view of the millennium was a post-millennial view. Okay, and for all of the reasons that we've just kind of gone over. The impact of Jonathan Edwards, Adam Smith, Matthew Henry, so on and so forth. And then it's about 1845-ish, give or take, when the historicist premillennial views of these guys in Britain begin to make an impact on what's going on in the United States. Lee?
Yes, in my opinion, What we know and appreciate about America historically, culturally, politically, and theologically, in my opinion, does indeed come from England. And I didn't think, I didn't personally appreciate all of that till I actually went and spent some time in England, and then you could see that much of that was, that's what we are. Especially you get into the south, into the Appalachian Mountains. Many of those people are really transplanted English and Scottish people. Scottish culture, Scottish theology, English thing. And that's my opinion.
And eventually, this premillennialism of the British that we've been looking at is going to come across and start to make an impact in the United States. All right. Now, it's going to do that first along what I'm going to call the millennial fringe. And we got two groups here that fit this. These would be the Shakers and the Mormons. All right? We'll talk about the Shakers first. Along the margins of this culture-shaping post-millennial juggernaut were a number of other distinctive and often controversial millenarianist movements. So, at this time in history, the vast majority of the country is post-millennial. Along the fringes or the outskirts of that post-millennialism, you have some groups that are going to begin to adopt different takes on the millennium. All right. So the first one I want to look at is the Shakers. In the 1770s, an English woman called Mother Ann Lee brought the United Society of Believers in Christ's Second Coming to America. Most popularly known as the Shakers for their distinctive worship style, her followers believed that Mother Ann was a female incarnation of Christ who intended to bring in the millennium by forming distinctive communities. Okay? So, this is definitely on the millennial fringe. This is not definitely mainstream millennial thinking of any sort, whether in Britain or in this country. According to the Shakers, the second advent had already occurred. They believed in the incarnation of God in Mother Ann Lee, the female and contemporary and complete complementary form to the Christ of the first advent. The coming of Mother Ann had inaugurated the millennium, the Shakers thought. And life in their celibate and semi-monastic communities represented their ideal of holiness and Christian perfection. So they believe that this woman, Mother Ann Lee, is a female incarnation of Christ, and she's a female complement to Christ's first coming. And they believe that she has already started the millennium and is in the process of spreading it, as it were, through the establishment of these semi-monastic, communities of Shakers. So eventually, the Shakers established 19 such communities from Maine to Florida, where they attempted to reproduce primitive Christianity. Shakers adopted simple lifestyles. Husbands and wives lived apart and turned their children over to be raised by the community, and no one had sex. Because of the latter restriction, the Shakers prospered only as long as the Second Great Awakening provided a stream of new converts, or as orphans found their way to the Shaker communities. On their best day, the Shakers numbered not more than about 5,000. Although their Messiah had already returned, the Shakers, during the 1830s, experienced an outbreak of enthusiasm, which included direct revelation, speaking in tongues, and visions of prophetic significance. Now, I got to tell you, if you look at that date, 1830s, what was going on, supposedly, in England in the 1830s? Remember, we went through the whole thing about Dave McPherson saying that the pre-tribulation rapture originated in 1830 with a tongue-speaking occult woman in Scotland. Then we looked at the other view that it originated in a tongues meeting in Edward Irving's church in 1832. And now we have reports in the United States of similar things happening amongst the Shakers. So I just point that out to you. I'm not necessarily making any kind of a grand statement about that, but it is interesting that at roughly the same time, both in Britain and in the United States, you have people reporting this type of Pentecostal activity, as it were.
Was Mother Ann from the United States then?
She was from Britain. She was from England and came to the United States.
So she.
But she came in the 1770s.
Okay.
So this was happening here.
Could they have heard about it from somebody in Britain?
I'm assuming they obviously could have, yes. I have not uncovered any piece of, information that would definitely say that's what happened. That doesn't mean it's not out there. I'm just not aware of it, obviously. So the Shakers, the Shakers are definitely not mainstream millenarians. All right, they are living off in these semi-monastic societies and doing and practicing ways of life that, most people are going to find kooky and not really want to have anything to do with.
Were the Amana colonies Shakers?
The what?
The Amana colonies. They're in Iowa. There's a huge colony. They're died out.
I'm not. I don't know.
It's a different group. It's different.
And I think the geographic stuff was from Maine to Florida, so basically along the eastern seaboard. Now, obviously, of greater significance, and even into our day, is the Mormons. Okay, in the 1830s, Joseph Smith founded the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints after he discovered and translated the Book of Mormon, allegedly. The Mormons believed that through them God was restoring the authentic apostolic gospel and reestablished the Aaronic priesthood. So the Mormons are going to be another group now that are going to be millenarians to some degree, but they're certainly not going to encompass the mainstream of what's going on in the United States during this time period. The first decades of Mormon history likewise reflected intense interest in the latter days, as the official name of their denomination made obvious. Originating in upstate New York and winning early converts primarily from Yankee stock, Joseph Smith taught an apocalyptic and premillennial eschatology. The Mormons' periodical was entitled The Millennial Star, and as they gathered for worship, the Latter-day Saints could choose from dozens of hymns, like the following one, which focused their attention on the dawning glory and the imminent judgment. So before we look at this hymn, I've put in here as an example of what the Mormons were thinking at the time. One of the interesting things about Joseph Smith is that his theology on the millennium is largely premillennial. Most of everything else he says is totally nuts, but he does think that Christ is going to return to and bring in a millennial reign. So the Mormons, to a degree, have to be included in this discussion, even though they are on the fringe or on the outskirts of the American millenarian movement. They definitely, as their name implies, the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints had a definite focus and emphasis on some things related to, the end times. Just look at this song real quick. Let Zion in her beauty rise. Have any of you ever heard this song before? I looked on the internet a little bit about this song, and apparently it's a fairly popular song. At least it was, not so much anymore, but even outside of some of the Mormon communities. Let Zion in her beauty rise, her light begins to shine. Ere long her king will rend the skies, majestic and divine. The gospel spreading through the land, a people to prepare to meet the Lord and Enoch's band triumphant in the air. Ye heralds, sound the gospel trumpet to earth's remotest bound. Go spread the news from pole to pole in all the nations round. That Jesus Christ in the clouds above, with hosts of angels too, will soon appear his saints to save, his enemies subdue. But ere that grand and solemn day, the stars from heaven will fall, the moon be turned into blood, the waters into gall. The sun with blackness will be clothed, all nature look affright, While men, rebellious, wicked men, gaze heedless on the sight. The earth shall reel, the heavens shake, the sea move to the north, the earth roll up like a scroll when God's command goes forth. The mountains shrink, the valleys rise, and all become a pale. The islands and the continents will then unite again. Alas, the day will then arrive when rebels to God's grace will call for rocks to fall on them and hide them from His face. Not so with those who keep His law. They joy to meet their Lord, in clouds above with them that slept, in Christ their sure reward. That glorious rest will then commence, which prophets did foretell, when Christ will reign with saints on earth and in their presence dwell. A thousand years, O glorious day, dear Lord, prepare my heart to stand with Thee on Zion's mount and never more to part. Then when the thousand years are past and Satan is unbound, O Lord, preserve us from his grasp by a fire from heaven sent down. Until our great last change shall come to immortalize this clay, then we in the celestial world will spend eternal day. So they're clearly premillennial in that song. It's clearly premillennial. Okay, that's why I picked that one. Yeah.
What year was that written?
You would ask me that, Norm, and I thought I knew. Let me look at the stuff at the... I want to say like 1847. So you might want to check that. You can find it easy on the internet if you just type in the name of the song. There's an entire Wikipedia entry about this song on the internet. So you can't read that and not see that he's talking about a literal thousand-year what? Reign. That Christ returns before that reign. So the Mormons are clearly premillennial here, according to this song that's in their sacred hymn book, along with many other similar things that we could have cited. I just used one because I think it gives the point. Early Mormon millenarianism was so intense, in fact, that Joseph Smith felt obligated to restrain his followers. He told his followers in 1842 that he had, after praying earnestly about the time of the Second Advent, heard a voice saying, "Joseph, my son, if thou livest until thou art 85 years old, thou shalt see the face of the Son of Man. Therefore let this suffice, and trouble me no more about this matter." So Joseph Smith obviously claims to be talking to God and says that God told him that they needed to back off their millennial zeal, if you will. Okay. So as the Mormons then move from New York to Ohio, from Ohio to Missouri, and from Missouri to Illinois to flee persecution, the focus of the group became admittedly more temporal as they struggled to survive. So as the Mormons are expelled out of state and territory and after territory here because of some of their views about marriage and other things that other more mainline Christian groups didn't like, they become more interested in surviving as a group necessarily than they do stressing some of the theology of the millennium. The triumph of the Mormon cause was anticipated through a cataclysmic judgment rather than a gradual conversion of the world. And since natural calamities had been predicted as one of the indicators of the nearness of this judgment, reports of fires, wars, and railroad and steamship disasters were regularly reported in the Millennial Star under the heading Signs of the Times. But while the Latter-day Saints waited anxiously for the fulfillment of these signs of the times, including the restoration of the Jews to Palestine, they were also laboring mightily to build the New Jerusalem in Utah. So one of the things that's interesting about the Mormons is they definitely talk about the millennium, yet they feel that they're building the New Jerusalem out in Utah. So they're sort of very confused, obviously, about this stuff. But you cannot deny the fact that they have a millenarianism to them that is some, quite frankly, if you know a lot about what the rest of they believe, it's actually quite stunning that they actually viewed the return of Christ in a premillennial term, and then also viewed there being a literal thousand-year millennium after which Satan would be loosed, and things happen according as you read them in the book of Revelation chapter 20 and 21. So, any questions or comments about the Shakers of the Mormons? Yeah?
Do you happen to know, or maybe we would remember, when Mitt Romney's father was the governor here? Were Americans aware that he was Mormon? Was that an issue back then?
Early 60s. It's more of an issue now than it was then.
It didn't bother people as much then. Okay.
But I think they're wrong and back off from the last election because of the opposition to Mormonism. And now it seems to be dissipated. No, the issue isn't being brought up anymore. Yeah. I don't know.
One thing that I have family that are Mormon.
Oh, really?
Yeah, my uncle's a Mormon and my aunt's a Mormon, and so I have some firsthand, you know, dealings with them about some of these things. One of the things about the Mormons is that they believe that the Constitution was inspired the same way the Bible was. So a lot of real strict conservatives in their view of the Constitution aren't going to mind a Mormon's view of the Constitution because of they view it as being inspired by God. That's a common Mormon view. Now, I don't know if that's an official teaching of the Mormon Church, but I know many Mormons view the founding documents of this country as having been inspired in the same way that the Bible was. In fact, my uncle has said that to me almost verbatim, that's what he thinks. So any other questions about that? So those are the millennial fringe. So you have the vast majority of Americans are post-millennial at the time. And you have a few groups that are on the outside that are really kind of kooky, the Shakers and the Mormons. And now the third guy that we want to look at today is a guy named William Miller. All right? William Miller is the most famous millenarian in American history. William Miller was far from being a fanatic. A self-educated farmer from Lowhampton, New York, he showed no interest in prophecy during his early years and was in fact something of a skeptic until he was converted in 1816. All right? So that's his picture over there. Now, William Miller is interesting. Reflecting more typical evangelical Protestant beliefs and practices were the followers of William Miller, a Baptist preacher from Vermont and upstate New York. A skeptical dentist, Miller was converted after the War of 1812 and began reading the Bible with the critical eye of a former rationalist. Using a historicist and premillennial approach to the study of Bible prophecy, he studied the numerology of Daniel and Revelation. Once he established past prophetic fulfillments as a starting point, he used millennial arithmetic and the year-day theory, which we've already talked about in here, to set a date of the second coming in about 1843. So William Miller now, he's a historicist. He applies the year-day theory, and he is going to say that the second coming of Christ is going to happen in 1843. All right, he's going to date set here and try to predict when it's going to happen. Now let's look at a few more things we got to understand about him. Precisely at the time that British prophetic interest began to stir, Miller became fascinated with interpretation of prophecy. Depending almost entirely on his own exegesis of the Bible, Miller developed a system of prophetic interpretation that came remarkably close to duplicating that being developed by the historicist premillennialist of Britain. So understand, around the same time, you have Irving and others in England. All right, they're over there in England. While that's happening, Miller is developing similar views of the millennium based on the same year-day theory and so forth in the United States of America. Okay? Now, I cannot substantiate any connection between these two guys at the time. I think that, from what I can understand, they are developing in relative isolationism from each other. I don't think they're corresponding. I don't think they're talking about it, at least, especially not at first. Over time, it probably is maybe reasonable to think that they did become aware of each other and possibly did talk to each other. But at first, they're developing their views, what seems to me, in isolation of each other. So it's interesting to think about how this is happening simultaneously in England and then also here in the United States. William Miller taught a doctrine of the last times that differed remarkably little from that proclaimed by the British 19th century millenarians. The main thrust of Miller's teaching was that Christ would return, the wicked would be judged, and the world cleansed by fire about 1843. His convictions were formed upon the same assumptions as were those of the historicist premillennialists in Britain, or of Britain, that the prophecies of the Bible were always literally fulfilled, and that chronological sequences in the apocalyptic book should be interpreted according to a year-day theory. That Miller fervently believed in the personal return of Christ need hardly be stressed. His emphasis upon the date of Christ's return, 1843, is often erroneously said to mark him off from the rest of the church, and more particularly the other millenarian parties. In fact, the expectation that the year 1843 would bring the next great cataclysm was quite common amongst historians pre-millenarians in both Britain and the United States. So here's the thing. Miller is not the only guy that's saying 1843 is the year for Christ's return. There are people in England, part of this Irvingite camp, that also thought there was significance with the year 1843. And if you remember back to lessons before the Christmas holiday, that's because they are using this year-day theory in their prophetic arithmetic. Now, the reason why Miller gets all the attention as far as America goes is because he's the only one in the United States at the time that is making such a claim. There are multiple people in England that are thinking this, but according to what I can gather so far, Miller is the only one in the United States around this same time that is making a similar prediction. But he was not the only one. There were ones in Britain that were doing and thinking similar things. All right? So, Miller's eschatology, though, did differ from British premillenarianism on two issues, however, and here Miller and his associates did not tolerate diversity. The Millerite did not accept the restoration of the Jews to Palestine as part of the prophetic timetable. So that's a big difference, okay? Nor were they willing to admit that Bible prophecy had any further promises to keep so far as the Jews were concerned. Okay? So if Miller says, number one, no restoration of the Jews, second, he says that no further prophecy refers or relates to who? Now, these guys here in England would not have agreed with him on these two points, as I should have demonstrated to you in earlier lessons. So Miller is in agreement with them with the arithmetic, but he doesn't agree with them about what the relationship of the nation of Israel is in this whole equation. Okay? And then apparently they are quite staunch in these two points right here. Quite dogmatic in them, according to both the sources that I read about this. Now, Miller arrived at these findings in 1818, but waited about 15 years before making them public. Thanks to new advertising and promotional techniques, his message generated a large following. Estimates from 30,000 to 100,000 drawn from evangelical denominations. So, if you look at America at the time, 1818, 15 years from that would be, you know, roughly around 1830, just give or take. To have a following of 100,000, is that pretty significant? That's pretty significant, okay? So we're not talking this mere little pittance now, like the 5,000 the Shakers had, or however many Mormons there were at the time, which I'm not aware of the total number of Mormons. So this is a more substantial movement, and it is affecting and reaching into the mainstream of this American evangelical, which evangelicalism, which is majority, as we've already said, is post-millennial. So Miller is picking off people from the mainline groups into his sort of position and understanding of the historicist premillennial view. All right. So, differing then from Mormons and Shakers on key points of doctrine, the Millerites never questioned traditional marriage, practiced unconventional sex, or altered the church's historic teaching about the Godhead. Likewise, Miller never claimed to be a prophet, only a careful student of the Bible, as he routinely invited people to check his calculations. So, he's not saying, hey, you need to come out and live over here with us like a bunch of, you know, weirdos or whatever, okay? He's never says he's a prophet. He never says God spoke to me. He never says anything like what Joseph Smith says. He just said, look, here's the Bible. Here's the way I understand it. Here's why I think what I think. Prove me wrong. All right? So he is much more traditional or orthodox, if you will, than either the Shakers or the Mormons were. So that explains why people are going to be, in larger numbers, attracted to William Miller and what he has to say, because he's not off in the boonies mentally in these other issues, like the Shakers and the Mormons were. So as the predicted time approached, Miller felt pressure to be more precise about the date for Christ's return. He eventually settled on October 22nd, 1844. Now, that may be a typo. I think that should say 1843. But I have it 1844 in the next one, too. So, we need to check that. I need to check that for the... But the main point is here that he does what? He sets a specific date and year. Okay? So he eventually settled on October 22, 1844, which set him and the Millerites up for what's called the Great Disappointment. Some Millerites returned to their former churches, but others established a number of new Adventist denominations. The largest was the Seventh-day Adventist Church, which made a few necessary adjustments to Miller's historicist premillennialism, and in time became famous for other characteristics such as worshiping on Saturday, vegetarianism, medical care, and missions. So this becomes known as, I'm just going to go with that date, hopefully I didn't mess it up. We'll say October 22, 1844, right? Now, the sun comes up, the sun goes down, and who doesn't show up? Christ doesn't show up, okay? So when Christ doesn't show up, this event then becomes known as the Great Disappointment. Alright? The Great Disappointment then is going to cause people in large numbers to flee Miller, okay? And from there, you're going to have the founding of the Seventh-day Adventists. Groups are going to become, they're the main ones that are going to come out of Miller after the Great Disappointment here and the thing doesn't happen. Okay? In comparison to the other millenarian alternatives discussed above, the early Millerites were the most orthodox and traditional premillennialists before the Civil War. But their very public failure dealt a serious blow to the credibility of premillenarianism, and confirmed most evangelical Protestants in their post-millennialist ways. Listen, when this thing doesn't go the way he says it will, what do the post-millennialists say? See, we told you. Right? So, the great disappointment for, you know, this happens 1844, before the Civil War, this really knocks back the number of people that are willing in this country to entertain premillennialism, is the point. Alright? On 22 October 1844, the sun sank as it had every day, had on every other day since creation, and Christ had not come. In retrospect, the Millerite movement appears to have virtually destroyed premillennialism in America for a generation. It took a long time for Americans to forget William Miller. Now, it's interesting. How many people have already forgot who Harold Camping is from last year? If I went to the average American and said, "Who's Harold Camping?" Huh? Who's that? If I went to the average evangelical Christian between, let's just say, between 1844 and 1860, and said, "Who's William Miller?" You think a lot of them would have known who he was? I would say a lot more would have known who William Miller is who know now who Harold Camping is. Okay? Because this great disappointment is going to really affect the number of American evangelicals that are going to be willing to entertain premillennialism for at least 15 to 20 years. Alright? So, in the end, folks, William Miller, like Edward Irving in the British movement, became a theological leper whose ceremonial denunciation was a part of the litany of millenarians for the next century. So, because of what Miller says, people are going to come along and say, those millenarians make predictions and they're always what? Wrong. Alright? Now, historicist premillennialism that Irving and Miller are involved in leads to date setting. Futurist premillennialism that Darby and the dispensationalists are going to advocate does not lead, or should not lead, to date setting. Okay? So, next week what we're going to look at then, now that we've established some things about the American millenarian movement between 1800 and 1860, the next thing we need to look at then is who coming over to the United States? Darby. Darby and the brethren now are going to come to the United States and they are going to import futurist dispensational premillennialism to the United States. Okay? And that's what we're going to look at next time. Now, I want to talk about some observations and some conclusions here. America experienced a series of unprecedented, America experienced a series of unprecedented social, political, and intellectual and religious crises in the next half of the 19th century. By almost every measure, the world was growing worse, not better. And demographic studies proved that the Christianization was not keeping pace with world population growth. What did devoted postmillennialists do when events ran counter to their eschatological expectations? Some held on, convinced that the golden age was still coming, despite the temporary setbacks. Others dropped their postmillennial expectations for other forward-looking causes, such as the social gospel, the progressive movement, and later on, the New Deal. Still others traded one kind of millenarism for another, a new kind of premillennialism, and eventually gained unprecedented success in the United States, and that's going to be dispensational premillennialism. Now, only after 1840 did British millenarian thought begin to attract attention in the United States. In 1820, the American Society for, monitoring, I think, the condition of the Jews was founded in the United States. The former London Jewish Society leader, Joseph S.C.F. Fry, contributing the first spark. Joel Jones, a lawyer, and Orrin Roger, a publisher, both from Philadelphia, appeared to have initiated their first republication of British millenarian literature. In 1840, they began a periodical entitled The Literalist, which simply reprinted the complete texts of premillennial works by British authors. In spite of the strong emphasis in American religion and churchly character of the British, the two nations were not developing in isolation. American and British clergy were continually and vitally concerned with the state of their sister churches, and each felt the impact of the other's ecclesiastical history. While the British millenarian tradition was being imported to this country, British overseas were commenting with interest on the developing Millerite movement and criticizing its theology and behavior. At the same time, the Millerite Adventists were winning converts in Great Britain. So you have an interesting phenomenon. People in Great Britain are saying, those Millerites, look at that, they're dumb. Meanwhile, there are people in Great Britain that are converting to the Millerite views. So was there clearly, after 1840, an interchange of the ideas back and forth across the Atlantic? Okay? And the last point then, with this free transatlantic exchange of ideas occurring, it was only a matter of time before the dispensational premillennialism of John Nelson Darby was transported to American shores. Upon its arrival, the futurist / dispensational understanding nearly captured the millenarian movement. So next week we are going to pick this up by looking at a study called Coming to America and how the Darbyite dispensational futurist views came to the United States and how they began to have an impact on the American millenarian movement. So does anybody have any questions or comments about any of this? Mike?
Well, just to show how civil religion and the Bible during that time, the great hymn, the Battle Hymn of the Republic is an example of post-millennialism that's still sung today in our society. And that was about the Civil War, time of the Civil War.
Yep.
Can't really tell if it's Bible or civil religion.
It's kind of all together. Yeah, post-millennialism, like the Methodist, has that deteriorated into liberalism. Then you get a lot of progressive stuff and social stuff. And that's basically where many of your Arminian Methodist types have gone today. They no longer embrace what we would call pure gospel salvation by grace. You see a definite progression in our world.
Yep.
And it's true, like you said at the very beginning, I don't know if you said it exactly this way, but to call America a Christian country today is just, there was a time when I think we could have legitimately have attached the name of Christian society, Christian culture, concept, but that's all gone, basically gone. We're the minority today.
Yeah, there was a, when I was in college, I took a U.S. history class, and one of the things we studied in that U.S. history class, have any ever heard of a guy named Frederick Jackson Taylor? Frederick Jackson Taylor was an American historian that said that when the American government officially shut down, or came out and said that the West was shut down for settlement, that it was a turning point in the history of the country because it ended that postmillennial dream of American Christianity. And at the time, I was like, yeah, whatever, that doesn't make any sense, blah, blah, blah. But now as I think back on that, based on some of the things that I read, I wonder if the guy didn't have a point. I don't know if that's the only thing that was going on, but we did come to a point in the country where it was blatantly obvious that this post-millennialism wasn't working. And when we came to that point, as Lee said, I agree that then you have the deterioration of that into other, quote, progressive things that are designed to try to make society better. And I don't know, that post-millennialism did end up working. And then along with that, at the same time, this great disappointment here, this affected the American millennial movement, in my opinion, pretty severely for at least about 20 years, give or take. Because it's not going to be until about the 1860s that the Brethren and Darby are going to start to come to this country, and their writings and their teaching ministries are going to start to have a fairly big impact on what's going on in the United States. And one of the things I think you're going to see as we go through here is that American denominationalists would not hesitate to raid Darby and the Brethren for their dispensational ideas, but then try to distance themselves as far from them as possible when it came to their views on the ruin of the church. Because one of the things that frustrated Darby more than anything else about his dealings in America was the refusal of the American men that were understanding dispensational thinking to leave their denominations. And so men like Brooks in St. Louis and Gordon in Boston and other areas, they never leave their American denominations, but yet they adopt, in some cases almost wholesale, Darby's futurist interpretation and dispensational model with modifications and tweaks of their own. But Darby was always frustrated with why these Americans won't leave their denominations. So there's definitely some things that are going to start happening now. So what we want to focus on from here moving forward is we're going to start next week talking about Darby's coming to the United States and his ministry in America. Then I want to look at, in the study after that, I want to look at the printing ministry of the Brethren and how the dissemination of their theological ideas through the printing of their periodicals and the republication and advertising of their books leads to a real awareness of dispensational thinking in the United States, even if there's an unwillingness on the part of these denominational guys to admit that they're getting it from the Brethren. Okay, I got some quotes of this one guy who writes the editor of a periodical, and he says, you know, why don't you just come out and say you're Brethren or something like that? And the guy writes a defense saying why he's not a Brethren, but then he basically concedes that half the eschatology that he's printed in his periodical he got from Brethren sources. So there's a real sort of rub here. And that's one reason why I spent time talking about the American denominational tradition back a few months back when we were looking at the old religion and the new world. Because America has been dominated by its denominational traditions.
One of the interesting things about the Brethren that Mike pointed out to me is that in their writings, they wouldn't put their names on them. They just put initials. And that made it really easy for people to just pull stuff out of there without having to pay any attention to copyright or original source.
Yeah.
One of the great examples of one of those who adopted a lot of that but never left their denominations was the great Presbyterian preacher, Donald Gray Barnhouse. Being a Presbyterian, he's obviously in a Calvinistic, very strong Calvinistic environment, but when it comes to teaching the Word of God, he was very dispensational, and he was very popular. But he never left. In fact, later on, when he died, they accused him of having a brain tumor because of what he taught. Really, that's true, right? He wouldn't have taught what he taught except he had a brain tumor.
Yes, we all have tumors. So anyway, that's where we're going to go next. And then once we've got that, then I'm going to trace for you the of the Bible Conference movement and how the Bible Conference movement and Niagara Bible Conference and so forth is dominated by denominational guys who understand Darby's dispensationalism. And how that began to capture the millenarian movement in the United States, and then how eventually through the publication of this Scofield Reference Bible and the popularity of it, that this little thing called dispensationalism hasn't gone away. Which is why a lot of non-dispensational people hate the Scofield Reference Bible, because of its influence and impact as far as propagating a dispensational approach to Bible study. That's down the road yet a ways. So, we'll see you next week.
They have compromised that Scofield Bible.